Good morning, Alan Alcoholic. A couple of things is that I didn't know if I was going to have 5 minutes after Damon started or if I was going to have 50 minutes. But thank you, Damon, for that nice introduction. And Johnny, I really appreciate you having me here today. I'm going to jump right into this, all right? Because when I've told my story before, I know that a lot of you got the memo on the Christmas, ugly Christmas sweater. I didn't get that memo. But I don't know if you guys got this memo for Johnny, but this meeting's lasting till 9:30 today. He's giving me an extra half an hour. Actually, no, I think it's really funny because, you know, when Damon says that I go back to the book, I really do. It saved my life, and we're going to hear a little bit about it today. We're not going to hear it all. You're going to have to come to hear my story a couple of two or three or four times to hear all the different things. I never know which way this is going to go, guys. I really don't. I wake up the morning that I get to talk and get the honor of being in front of other alcoholics. And I just told Jim, didn't I? I said a little prayer. I say, God, may your thoughts be my thoughts today. May your words be my words. And may your actions be my actions. And it always wasn't that way for me, but God does for me what I can't do for myself, and I didn't recognize that when I was out there using. And it was really funny because I get to that part in the book, the big book, where it says we alcoholics are undisciplined. You know that part? Everybody know it? Come on, this is a you know, you can kind of respond. Yes? You guys know that one? All right. I always think it's funny is that next word it says we ask God to direct our thinking. To discipline us, something like that. And I always think it's kind of funny because I always think that, you know what, God must be really present in AA meetings because the one thing that we're very disciplined about is that guy better be done by 9 o'clock. Better be done at 9 o'clock. Aren't you one of them? I'm one of them. You know, I'll be sitting there on a Monday and Kevin will raise his hand at 9:06. And Kevin will start in, and I'll look at Robin going, oh, man, I got somewhere to go. So I'll try to get us done before 9:10 because I know we have a special medallion today. And I wasn't always caring, and I wasn't always considered any everybody. Okay, and you're going to hear those stories, a little bit of them about them today. But I am, and Charlie's a special guy in my program, and my story today is going to be my stories about my miracles and of my heroes. And Charlie's one of my heroes, and he didn't even know it. There's a lot of them in this room. Hell, Damon's one of my heroes. There's one of my heroes that just spoke the other day. He talked about a pause. He talked about a pause, you guys. This is just the other day on Monday. A guy in this room talked about he was going to dial numbers. He didn't say what the numbers were to, but I thought that maybe he's to a dealer or something. And he paused and he prayed instead. And you're going to start to hear the stories of my miracles because that was a miracle. That was a miracle that happened. And my miracle and my heroes start this way. I'm going to cut to the chase. I'm going to take you to my very first meeting. I'm not going to start on March 3rd, 1965 when I was born because we don't have time for that. I think you guys are here to hear the recovery part, right? Are you guys here to hear the recovery part? I have a funny story to tell you about that. It was the very first time I told my story, and I showed up at OMD, Outright Mental Defectives, in downtown St. Paul one Tuesday, and I said something at that meeting that I had heard at another meeting, and it sounded really smart, and I just had started working with Patrick B., okay? And this guy shimmies up to me after the meeting and says, man, I liked what you said. You know what? We just had a late cancellation on our speaker meeting for Saturday. Are you available? I went. And my sponsor at the time, Patrick B., mentioned to me that I shouldn't really make decisions on my own. Because when I first got here, my thinking stunk. Anybody else's? And he helped me to think. And I said, you know what? My sponsor said I should ask him. And so I said, I'll get back to you an hour. He gave me a number. I called Patrick. I said, Patrick, I'm at OMD, and the guy asked me to be a speaker. He says, you need to say yes. And I'm like, oh, my God. And it was the first time I'd ever been at OMD. First time. I'd heard about the meeting, but, you know, it was like 60, 70 people like this. So, you know, Patrick says, I'll be there. I'll support you. We'll get together on Thursdays. I got together with my sponsor at 5:30 on Thursdays, and I'll help you with it, Alan. So he instructed me on that Thursday night to tell in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today, right? And we did it. And I get there, an OMD speaker on a Saturday night at 7, ain't 60 or 70 people. There's like 300 people there. And I was shaking. I mean, I was like this. I mean, I really was. I was like this. Patrick sat in the back, and I started in on my drunk-a-log. You know those drunk-a-logs? I drank this much then and all that stuff. And, you know, everybody's trying to prove to you they're alcoholic. Right? And I'm doing that. I'm 20 minutes in it. And I ain't kidding you. Some of you guys met Patrick, right? Anybody met Patrick? Yeah. Okay, at this time, you guys met Patrick when Patrick was 6'4 and about 220, right? That's what he looked like when he came here a couple of months ago. At that time, Patrick was 6'4 and about 450. 450. We had a spiritual situation happen at the International, at AA International here in Atlanta. I had just moved to Atlanta and I invited Patrick down. Patrick got 12-stepped into OA at the International AA Conference. Lost 200 pounds, 250. But anyway, he's in the back and I'm starting my drunk log. I'm 20 minutes in it and he stands up and he says, "Hey!" I ain't kidding you. He stands up, right back where Josh is, says, "Hey, when are we going to get to the recovery part?" Stop me in the tracks. You're here for recovery, and I know that. So I'm going to take you to my first meeting. You want to go along? Anybody here for their first meeting? We asked that. But is anybody here for their first meeting? Anybody under 30 days of sobriety in here? Fantastic. I know how you feel. Here's my first meeting, so I'm going to take you back to July 9th. My sobriety date is July 10th, 2009, and there's a funny story about it, because it changed. It used to be July 9th, 2009. I'll take you back to July 8th, and I'll tell you kind of what was going on, and I tell it in three strikes. You know, I was just like you. I was drinking, and drinking became my solution. I drank in good times, and I drank in bad. Right? Sickness and in health. Right? Good times and bad, sickness and health, money, no money, job, no job, wife, no wife. You get it? I was drinking all the time. And in July 8th was no different. It was a Wednesday. You can go back. You calendar nuts can go right back. July 8th was a Wednesday. And my kids, I have a son and a daughter from my first marriage. Yeah, I've got multiple marriages like you do. But I have two children. One is Ryan. He's 26 years old. He's a first lieutenant in the United States Air Force, United States Air Force. He is stationed in Spangdahlem, Germany, which is the NATO base, the fighter jet base in Spangdahlem, Germany, which is in the southwest corner, kind of like the Napa Valley of Germany, in all the grapes and all that stuff. And my daughter's a senior. She's 22 years old right now. She's a senior at Iowa State University, and she's majoring in event planning and management. These two children are awesome. I have two stepchildren. Their names are Ryan. My first is Ryan. Diane's first is Ryan. Remember that. It gets weird. It gets weirder. And Brandon. And Ryan is an engineer for the aircraft carrier manufacturer up in Newport News, Virginia, and Brandon is a senior at James Madison University. We have a wonderful family. But anyway, I take you back to 2009, so my son and daughter at that time are, you know, 16 and 12. 16 and 12, and I'm pretty well winding down. I'm pretty been spinning that tornado roaring through the lives of others. I never can remember these things, and you know, I'll remind you what it says on page 82. On page 82, when it says about that tornado, is hearts are broken. I started breaking my kids' hearts because I stopped showing up for them. Anybody else? Remember those days? Sweet relationships are dead. People that loved me like my mother and father, they stopped calling too. They were tired of Al too. I just was tiring people out. You know what that feeling was? You remember those feelings? Affections have been uprooted. Man, those things hit me. And that was what was happening in July. July 8, 2009, I drank just like I always did. I drank to forget and to be forgotten. You know, a little bit earlier in July, I started to notice the people that people were starting to notice how much I drank. I had taken notice. You know, I started going to different liquor stores and all that kind of stuff, and I started taking my empties to different dumpsters and things like that, so the garbage men wouldn't know I was drinking. And one day I was sitting there, and it was just before July 8th. My house was the house that all the kids came to because I had the pool, I had the hot tub, I had the trampoline, I had all these things for the kids because I thought that's what they wanted. They wanted the items. They wanted the things. And the kids would all be there, and I'd make frozen pizzas for them. And one night, Ashley, one of my son's friends, said, "Hey, Mr. D, you having a drink tonight?" And as I was taking my glass and starting to put the ice in it and pouring the whiskey in it and topping off with club soda, and right over my left shoulder before I could say a word, my son, "Oh, no." My son says, "Oh, no, he'll have five or six or more." People were taking notice. People were noticing. I didn't think people cared how much I drank. I didn't even really care. But one did. There was one person that liked hanging out with me. Her name was Lou. She had a farm. Our sons were good friends. And she had a farm in which she had horses. And she would do therapeutic riding for special needs young adults, right? Okay. Her daughter had Angelman's disease. And her friends had cerebral palsy and autism. And she needed a strong guy to show up on Thursdays to help get them up on the horse. We had made this platform. Remember this platform? You go up at three steps. You get on the platform. Anybody been to one of those horse farms? They bring the horse in there. And then some of the people, you know, you have to jimmy them up even a little bit further to put them on this custom saddle. Why was that guy? And that Thursday, July 9th, after I'd been drinking regularly, I was just like that. You know, I wasn't that strong. I was kind of weak that day. And I was at that farm. And one of the individuals that I had to help was Matt. And Matt was he was a cerebral palsy victim. And he was in a wheelchair, and I'd get him up, and I would take him up the stairs of that platform, and I'd get him at the top of that platform, and I wasn't feeling on top of my game that day. And I got him about two-thirds of the way up to that saddle, and I didn't know then that God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. But one of those miracles I talked about earlier, I'm going to tell you the stories of my miracles and my heroes. Here's one of the miracles. Matt made it up on that saddle, and I don't know how. I walked outside that barn, I grabbed my phone, and I had met a guy previously, about 20 years earlier. His name was Tim, and Tim was one of those smart guys. He was with American Express, and I was IDS Financial Services' top producer. And he was in the home office, and he'd come up with great ideas to work out in the field in the investment industry, and they would try him out on me in Des Moines, Iowa. And I was his guinea pig. And we became friends. And from then on, from 1987 through still today, we talked two or three times a year, and I called Tim because I thought he might be able to relate, because I think Tim told me he had gone to Hazelden. And I thought, maybe I need help. And I called Tim that day, and I said, "Tim," I said, "I'm tired. I'm just tired. I'm tired. I'm just tired. I think I need rehab." Tim said, "Just stay right where you're at. I'm going to have a friend call you. And that friend was Floyd O. He's one of my heroes. And you're going to hear a lot about Floyd here at the beginning of my story. Floyd called me and he asked me all kinds of questions, and I really don't know all the things he said, but he did say one thing. He said, "You going to drink today, Alan?" I said, "I don't think so." He said, "If you do think you're going to drink, call me. Otherwise, I can meet you on Saturday, which is the day after tomorrow, and I'll visit with you at Chili's in Woodbury, because I think that's about halfway between your house and mine." And I said, "That'd be great." And so after Lou was done with the kids and the horses, she came out. I was sitting in the lawn chair. I wasn't feeling on top of my game like I told you. And she came over and she said, "What happened?" And I told her what happened. And I said, "What do you think this guy's going to tell me on Saturday?" She drops this on me. She says, "He's probably going to say that you're an alcoholic." That's the first time anybody had ever said that to me. he's probably from Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's probably going to say you're never going to drink again. So on Thursday night, July 9th, which should have been my sobriety date, I always started drinking at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Any of you guys like that? 4 o'clock rolled around, I grabbed my drink glass, put ice in it, put Windsor in it, and off I went. Off I went. I didn't drink at 4 o'clock on Thursday, July 9th. It got to 7 o'clock, I didn't drink. Man, this was a major accomplishment for me. At 8 o'clock, I thought, man, maybe some ice cream would be great. Maybe some ice cream. And so I get in the freezer, and I know all you guys did this too, but my Windsor, my whiskey, that was my drink of choice. I always put it in the freezer. I liked ice cold whiskey. That's what I liked. I saw it sitting there next to my ice cream, and the thought that Lou had said that you might not drink again came in my mind. And just like any other good alcoholic, I'm like, why should we waste that whiskey? And I drank once more. Let me tell you that last drink. Some of you guys can remember that last drink. I can. It tastes just like poison. God for doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. It tasted horrible. Now, you got to remember, in the recovery part, we're going to find out when I first drank. I started drinking whiskey at a very young age. At a very, very young age. You see, I was born to Don and Lois. I have four older sisters, and then the baby boy came along. Yep, I was spoiled. I was spoiled rotten by my sisters. Don and Lois Dow. Don was a John Deere dealer. Lois was a city clerk. And just like you always hear about a lot of alcoholics, my parents were the epitome of integrity. They did all the right things at the right times, even when no one was looking. You know that old joke? They did, though. I was raised in a happy family, but a couple of things I want you to remember when we get to recovery. Every night, my dad was not alcoholic, my mom wasn't either. I never saw them intoxicated to the level of drunkenness ever in my life. Okay, but my dad did have one drink every night. My dad could have one drink every night. He'd come home, and I remember my sisters and I would race to the kitchen to see who could get there first when we heard my dad coming up the alley and into the driveway. And we would, one of us would grab his glass and we'd put it with ice and we'd pour his Canadian Club whiskey into that glass and we'd top it off with 7-Up, not club soda. He liked that sweetness from 7-Up. And before we handed that to him, when we handed that drink to him, we would get a sip as a reward. We'd get a sip. Now remember, I was really young when I started doing this. And I don't know when it was, but you're going to hear it in the recovery. You're probably going to figure it out like I did, that when I started, the sip became a drink. And when the drink became a gulp. And when the gulp became even half the glass. And then I would pour 7-Up and Canadian Club in it again so my dad wouldn't know I'd drink half of his drink. It happened. So Floyd meets me on Saturday, and we go through. He was by the book. You know, in chapter Working with Others, it says start up in a general conversation, right? He did. He took me through a general conversation. The conversation quickly switched to my drinking habits, and he told me about his drinking habits. Don't know much more about that, but he did say he started to outline this program of action, he called it. And he kept on calling it spiritual. And I started going, whoa. You know, kind of like that thing when Abby says, I got religion, and Bill goes, whoa. I did the same thing. I did the exact same thing. And I started to go, man, this guy's kind of weird, but I really like him. And all of a sudden he dropped this on me, and he goes, you know, I learned this through going to groups of my friends. Would you like to meet some of my friends? And I said, sure. And so he said, I meet with them on Sunday nights at 7:30, which was July 12th. And these dates mean something here in a minute. On Sunday, July 12th, I walked into Our Savior's Church in Stillwater, Minnesota. There were 60 or 70 people there that night. And I walked in, and Floyd was introducing me to everybody I don't remember. And we sit down, and Pete is at the front of the table, you know, way down there, kind of like Johnny was today. And I'm in the back with Floyd, and I'm watching Pete, and I'm going, man, I want to be like him because, you know, I grew up being the big shot. Anybody else here with a big shot? You know, always had to be the big shot in grade school, high school, on the playground, when you got in your professional life and everything else. Well, I was going to be a big shot, obviously, right away. I was watching Pete to know what he did because I was probably going to be doing that in a day or two. You know? I mean, anybody else do this stuff? Anyway, it starts the spiritual start of my recovery starts today. This was a split-up meeting. It's kind of like us on Saturday. Beginners go in there. They had the big book people go in there, and the step people stay here. And Floyd tapped me on the shoulder and said, we're going to stay here. Sorry. And there was 33 people left over in that room. Ready for this? This is what happened that day. And this starts recovery. Our first meetings are very important, right? Everybody remember their first meeting? Most of us do. Here's what happened. 33 people were in there. I counted them. Floyd's the first guy that starts. And we do something fun up north. When a newcomer comes in to a step meeting, any meeting actually up there, we stop everything. We go to the first step. Okay? We go to the first step. We don't care where we're at in the steps, in the big book, in a topic. We do first step. And these guys were professional first steppers that night. Floyd started off and he looked right at me. Just like this, Johnny. He looked right at me. And he said, Alan, you're the most important person in this room. Now, remember, I was that tornado. Everybody was tired of me. I hadn't heard that I was important for a long time. I hadn't heard the words love in a long time, even from my kids. Floyd looked at me again. He said, Alan, you're the most important person here today. And I'm like, whew. And he said, with that, I'll pass. And it went to a couple other people, and then it got over to Dave O, kind of where Corey's sitting. Right where Corey's sitting. And Dave O had this gray beard. I can still remember him today. And he said, Alan, I don't know if you're an alcoholic, but if you are anything like me, when you start drinking, you don't know if you're going to have two drinks or 22. You see, I've lost the control of drink. I can't control and enjoy drink any longer. So if you're anything like me, you're in the right place. With that, I'll pass. Went to a couple more people, and Monica comes up, and she drops some stuff on me. Corey the other day, anybody here the other day when Corey talked about lingo? The lingo that we have in these rooms, you know, phenomenon of craving, sponsor. You know, we throw this stuff at people, and we expect them to understand it. And Monica was awesome. She dropped some of that stuff on me that I still remember today. She dropped this on me. She said, Alan, I don't know if you're an alcoholic, but if you're anything like me, you're not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. I ain't got no disease, I say to myself. She looks at me again and she goes, Alan, I don't know if you're an alcoholic, but if you're anything like me, you're not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. Because I found out by coming to these rooms that I have something, an obsession of the mind, and I didn't know what obsession meant. But I believed her because she's looking right at me. And she said, I have an obsession of the mind and I have an allergy. Once I start drinking, I can't stop. It's the first time I'd ever heard that. God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And all of a sudden I was going, wow, maybe I do belong here. It got to Monica and I started thinking, man, maybe I belong here. And she said, I'm told that this is a progressive disease and it always gets worse. It never gets better. She said, Alan, if you are alcoholic, and I don't know if you are, but you got a chronic disease that ain't ever going away. And I'm starting to get scared a little bit. And then she said, worst of all, Alan, we found that left untreated, if you are alcoholic and you do have alcoholism like me, it's fatal. It kind of scared me. Went a couple more people, and remember PD? Remember PD, guy in charge? He'd been reading my mind. He dropped this on me. This stuff really happened in my first meeting. P.E. said, he goes, Alan, I don't know if you're alcoholic or not. They all said that. That was pretty cool, wasn't it? I don't know if you're alcoholic or not. But you know, I always had to be the big shot. Holy shit. Pete's just like me. He goes, I had to be the big shot on the playground when I was a kid. I had to be the big shot when I get into grade school and high school. And then when I got in my profession, I had to be the big shot. I'd be number one. I didn't matter who was in charge or who was in my way. I was going to run them over. Matter of fact, Alan, I walked into my first meeting. He's saying this right over there. Petey goes, I walked in my first meeting and I looked at the guy that was doing the meeting, leading the meeting, and I was like, I'm going to be like that guy. He did. He dropped that on me, and I'm like, man, he knows, he's just like me. God's doing for me what I can't do for myself, and a couple more people, and then I'll get on to recovery with Patrick. Next person is Rich. And Rich is a farrier. You guys know what a farrier is? He puts horseshoes on horses. He clips their toes. He's a tough guy. And he's an old hockey player, and my son's being recruited as a Division I hockey player. And we're going all over the country, and so Rich knows my kid. And I like Rich. But he's an old coot. But a smart one, because he drops this on me. He says, Alan, I don't know if you're alcoholic or not, but if you're anything like me, when I drink, I get thirsty. And the more I drink, the thirstier I get. And I went, Shazam, me too. And I meant it. I looked right at Rich and I said, me too. Anybody else like that? When you drink, do you get thirsty? The more you drink, the thirstier you get? Yeah. Years later, at Gopher State, I heard a woman from Dallas say that same thing. And I'm like, wow. And then I'll tell you one last person in that meeting of those 33 people. Actually, there were 32. I was the 33rd. Is Anna. And if there's the nicest woman in AA, it's Anna. And I usually can't make it through this one. But Anna, she's a special lady. And she says something like this to me. She looks me right in the eye and she says, you know, when I came in these rooms, Alan, these people told me that they had loved me until I could love myself. And I'm like, okay. She goes, no, let me tell you. I was in a place where I couldn't even talk to my parents. Me too. My children weren't talking to me. Me too. Nobody wanted to be around me. Me too. And all of a sudden these people said, let me love you until I can love myself, until you can love yourself. She looked at me and she said, I've got a couple of gifts for you today. One's a phone list. And it's of everybody that's in this group. But she said, I've highlighted everybody that's in this meeting. And you can call any of us. We'll do almost anything for you. We'll take you to another meeting. We'll talk to you on the phone. If you think you're going to drink or you need to get to a meeting, we'll do it. We really like you. We're really glad you were here today. And we're going to give you this book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took that book and I went home and Floyd and I were going out of the meeting and Floyd said, well, what did you think of your first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, Floyd, I really enjoyed myself. Thanks for taking me here. I said, you know what the funny thing was, Floyd, is that there were 33 people in that little step meeting you called. 32 of them were just like me. And Floyd looked back at me and he said, spiritual, Alan, spiritual. God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself at that time. Floyd said, would you like to go to another meeting? I said, absolutely. And he took me to River Rats on Thursday. But we have to kind of skip through that because I only have about 10 minutes left because I really want to get to the big book. A few weeks later, this isn't my journey. I didn't all of a sudden just have it perfect, guys. Because I walked around here for the next 2 years a dry drunk. You guys know those dry drunks? Have you ever seen a dry drunk? You ever seen a person that's dying in the meetings? Okay, I can see those people, so you can't hide. You know that old saying, spot it, you got it? I find it real quick because I was one of those guys. I was one of those guys that people would pat on the back because I'd say something smart at one meeting that I heard at one meeting and I'd say it at the next meeting and they'd go, God, you're doing one hell of a program, Alan. Keep it up. And I'd go home and I'd go, what the hell is wrong with me? Right? The dry drunk. About 2 or 3 weeks later, and I know it's easy for you to say, why didn't you ask Floyd to be your sponsor? Everybody says that. Why didn't you ask Floyd to be your sponsor? I didn't. I asked this guy at Saturday Morning Serenity in Bayport, Minnesota, a meeting that I had been attending for 2 or 3 weeks. I asked him, I said, would you be my sponsor? And he said this, you need to call me every day. You got one of those? You need to call me every day. Anybody got a big book in front of them? Turn it to page 112, would you please? And then he said something that almost killed me. And I have to apologize. I'm not trying to kill anybody in this room, but we got to be careful, people. We really do. And this is what happened. Read the first. He says to me, Alan, you got to call me every day, and I want you to turn to page 112, and I want you to do exactly what the first three words on page 112 say. What do they say, Tim?
Read this book.
Read this book. You start to see the passion in this guy. You see my voice start to get a little higher now. That guy nearly killed me that day. Read this book. It says somewhere in this book, this is a textbook. Do you read a textbook or do you read a novel? From that day forward for 2 years, I thought this thing was a novel. And I might start to shake here because I almost died before your eyes. You remember that platform that I put those kids on, that I gave a little bit of life to? This is what happened a couple years later when I was reading the book alone. Doing it, do it yourselfer. On a Friday night, I made my way out to the horse barn. That same horse barn that now I'd lost a couple houses. I'd gotten evicted from a couple houses. I got my electricity turned off. You know, the whole stories of alcoholism, you know. And Lou had a little hired man apartment on her farm that she said, you can stay there if you feed my horses. And I really needed that. But this Friday night, the second Friday in May, I kind of remember it, I shimmied out to the barn, and I got on that platform, and I put a ladder on that platform. You know those three-step platform that I put those kids on? Remember that? I know I said it already, but you remember that one? Made those kids so happy when they were riding those horses. Yeah, I threw a rubber hose up over the rafter. 2 years after a guy said, read this book. And I thought it was do-it-yourself time. Next thing I know, I'm out in the back pasture of that farm. I'm on my knees, and it's one of those gloomy spring nights. It almost like fall, like, you know, those really dark clouds, really kind of dark, but it wasn't thunderstormy. It was really dark. And I looked up over my right shoulder, and obviously you can tell it really happened. I mean, I'm looking still today, and the moon was shining through those dark clouds. God doing for me what I can't do for myself. The words popped into my mind. His light will shine through even the darkest of times. His light will shine through even in the darkest of times. This shit happened, you guys. This happened. I woke up the next morning on Saturday morning. I went to Saturday morning serenity. And at that, I sat in that same chair. I know that Kevin challenges us at the center table to change up things. I've always been this way. I had this special place on the sofa at Saturday morning serenity, and Harold was right over there. Harold was getting a chip for 30, 33, 35 years. It's not important, but he said, you know, I ran around here thinking this was a do-it-yourself program. He did not know I had a hose around my neck the night before, not wanting to live any longer, doing it on my own. He didn't know that. But Harold was talking right to me that morning. And he said something like this. I ran around here and I couldn't figure it out. And I had this committee in my head going crazy. And I was angry, and I was irritable, and he pulled that restless and discontent out. And he said, then one day somebody suggested I hit my knees. And I heard those words. Instead of read the book, he said, hit your knees. I got out of that meeting, and I know you guys know I'm social, and I'm trying to get through this, you guys. I went out that door, I went home, and I hit my knees. And, you know, I was used to those foxhole prayers that we all had, you know, get me out of this one, I'll never do it again type of thing. I started praying differently. It was really funny. This guy back here, show him your tattoo. He's got this tattoo, and I said those exact things. You know, you guys taught me the Serenity Prayer, acceptance, courage, and wisdom. I started asking for acceptance and courage and wisdom and love and acceptance. My prayers changed that day. It was weird, and all kinds of weird things happened after that, and I don't know how I'm going to get through this in 10 minutes. But I started praying for those things, and weird things started to happen, people. I didn't get to tell you this, but back in 1985, I tore a heart out of a woman's body, and I threw it on the ground. I was between my sophomore year and junior year, and I was a football player in college, and I was going back to my hometown, and I was everything. Or I thought I was. And I met this girl I'd never met in my hometown. My hometown is 3,300 people. Okay, you know everybody. And never met this girl, and I met her in 1985, in the summer of 85. Man, she stole my heart. And I made love for the first time in my life, I think. I think I made love for the first time in my life that summer. At the end of the summer, I took her heart out of her body, and I threw it on the ground. I stomped on it. I put it in her heart, and I said, have a nice life. Actually, I wasn't that considerate because I just didn't return her phone calls. She'd call me at college, and she'd say to my roommates, is Alan there? I really want to talk to Alan. And they'd say things like, he's at the library. Yeah, right. He's working out. Yeah, right. I was sitting right there. I was inconsiderate. So all of a sudden, August 14th, 2011, remember I had the hose around my neck, second Friday in May? Harold says, hit your knees. I start doing it. I stop reading the book. I start hitting my knees. And God does for me what I can't do for myself. I open up my computer on August 14th at 7:32 at night. I open it up to Facebook, and there's a private message from somebody. Her name is Diane. Diane was that woman 26 years earlier that I ripped that heart out. She was fixing to ask me how I had raised my children because my kids didn't look divorced. You know, I didn't tell you, but my son graduated the Air Force Academy, top of his class in national security. My daughter is at the top of her class at Iowa State with a 3.9 or 4.0. They did it despite me. But she saw me on Facebook with my kids, and she goes, I want that. And things took off from there. I was at a chicken feed. Remember, I was hitting my knees. I was at a chicken feed it was an AA chicken feed. And Nancy, one of my friends from Saturday Morning Serenity, sat down next to me. And she handed me a flyer. And the flyer was a big book study. Big book study. You know, I'd read the book by myself and almost died. I was a little scared of the big book, you know. And she said, I think you'd like this. And do we have 10 minutes? Can you guys wait till 5 after 9? Because Patrick, you guys got to hear Patrick. And so anyway, I go to this big book study, and I'll make it very quick. It's one of those Joe and Charlie kind of big book where they read. They have four people up in front. Ann was there. Dick was there, Bucky was there, and Patrick was over there, and I was sitting right where Johnny was. I was in the second row, and they would read, you know, a paragraph or two, and then they'd share their experience, right? And every time Patrick would say something that happened to him, I was going, me too. Just like that first meeting, me too. And every time Patrick would say something that he felt, I'd go, I felt that same way. And then I started saying to myself that Friday night, maybe this thing can happen for me too. I went home and I slept on it. I came back and I remember it. It was really great. I was sitting here and I'm planning out how I can get Patrick cornered. And we get to the first break and Patrick's making a break for that door. And I know this door's right here, so I'm going to get him right there. I don't know that he has to go to the restroom. I'm still a little inconsiderate. But Patrick starts this way, and I go that way, and we meet in the hallway, and I go, I'm Alan D. Nice to meet you, Patrick. Patrick just kind of looks at me and says, what can I do for you? I got to get to the head. I'll make this quick. Everything you say happened to you happened to me. Everything you say you felt like it, I felt like it too. I was wondering if you'd be my sponsor. And he looked at me. Ready? He looked at me and he said, "You're pathetic and you disgust me." Yeah. Most people react the same way you guys do. Jaws drop. And there's some of you guys that are looking at me like, "I know what that's like." Because you see, I went, "Man, how does this guy know me?" Because I was pathetic. And I disgusted myself at that time. He said, "I'll meet you at my reading room." He was going to make it difficult. This is 50 miles away from downtown Minneapolis. He's going to make it difficult for me because he doesn't like me. He made that known the very first time I met with him. And I'll tell you that. Is that he said, "You know, we can meet. I've got one time open. I've sponsored a lot of guys. I got 5:30 Thursday nights at the reading room. You know where the Federal Reserve is in Minneapolis?" I said, "I do." He says, "You got to be there at 5:30. You're 1 minute late. I door shut and you're not going to be sponsored by me and you don't get a second chance." This is Patrick. This is awesome. This is what I needed, guys. It's unbelievable. So I show up. He doesn't know this, but God has been doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. My office was a mile north of downtown Minneapolis. I was there at 5:15. He opened up the book to the title page. It's what I do with my men. We start at the title page, and he read every single word from that page through the preface. No, to the table of contents, to the preface, to the four to the first edition, four to the second edition. Let me tell you, things change about the second time I met with him because we got to the four to the second edition. Anybody know the four to the second edition? You know what saved my life? Has anybody ever heard this yet? Let me read this to you because this might what we might end on, and we can talk about my recovery the rest next time. But the four to the second edition, you know, because when I was doing it yourself, where do you start on a book when you were doing it yourself? When that guy said, "Read the book," where did I start? Page one. What was page one? Bill's story. You know what saved my life? It was the four to the second edition. See that? That's forward to second edition. Think that pink and yellow and all that stuff means something to me? It does. Listen to this. Catch this. Now remember, God's doing for me what I can't do for myself. He sent Patrick to save my life. Patrick dropped this on me. It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery. And when we were on the title page, he had me define recovered. And I said it was to return to a normal state of mind and body. And he said, "I'm going to read this sentence back to you, backwards. And I want you to define a couple words for me before I do that. You've already defined recovered. You said it was to return to a normal state of mind and body, didn't you, Alan?" I said, "Yes, I did." Patrick said, "What's permanent mean?" And by that time, he was trying to sweep away my old prejudice. And I would say something, he'd say, "Shut up and look it up." And I'd look it up and it would say, "Indefinite, everlasting, that's permanent." Then there was vital. He said, "I want you to tell me what vital says." "It's necessary," I came up with. He said, "That's good enough." "I want you to define strenuous." And I found something that said vigorous, active. Or like what we say in Iowa, getting after it. So he said, "Let me read that back to you, Alan." Now remember, a couple years before, somebody told me to read the book. Read this book. Now listen to this. Patrick said, "You told me you wanted recovery. It's right here in the book. I ain't lying. You wanted recovery." I said, "Yes, I do. I want it to return to its normal state of mind and body." And you want it to be permanent, right, Alan? I said, "Yeah, I want it forever and ever and ever." He said, "Then it's vital. It's necessary that you work with another alcoholic." Whoops. "Work with another alcoholic. Work with another alcoholic. Doing strenuous work. Getting it after it. Are you willing to do that, Alan?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I'll see you next Thursday." And that started a journey that I don't have time for. And I will tell it. If you have me back again, I'll tell that story. And it is a fabulous story of how he took me through this big book. I know that Corey thought I was going to go out of the big book this morning. He told me that when I was walking in. And I just don't have time to do it today. I hope that you have me back. I hope you have me back because I will start where I stopped off right here today. I'm here to tell you that we have an important job here. I'm not giving you advice and I'm not telling you what to do. That's for your sponsor. And I don't want to kill anybody. But what saved me was working with another alcoholic. It's sponsorship's a big deal. When that guy told me to go to 112 and read the first three words and do what it said, that was a death sentence, guys. It says right in the book somewhere that this is a textbook. And whenever I worked with a textbook, I worked with what? A teacher. I pick up a novel to read. I don't pick up a textbook to read. So my message today is this. Sponsorship. Working with another alcoholic. You guys are all my heroes. You're part of my miracle. We don't have time to finish this because I only had about 40 minutes. Usually I talk for an hour and a half. I hope, Johnny, you'll invite me back that I can tell the rest of the story some other time. I will skip to the shortest paragraph in the book. Anybody know what the shortest paragraph in the book? Don't answer it, hey, Damon. Carolyn, what's the shortest paragraph in the book? No. Kevin?
It works. It really does.
It works. It really does. I'm living proof that this is not a do-it-yourself program. This is a program meant to do with another alcoholic. It's vital for your permanent recovery. Do you want recovery for yourself? Do you want to return to your normal state of mind and body? Do you? Do you want it to be permanent? I'm recovered. I don't say recovering. I'm recovered. The title page says, this is a story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered precisely. And it's done one alcoholic with another. And it's as easy as open up to the title page, just like my sponsor did. And that's how I did it. Others might do it differently. That's the only way I know. It works, it really does. And with that, I'll pass.